Okay, this is close enough. Wednesday, April 12th, we'll start the meeting for the Board, Lincoln County Board of Commissioners. It's another beautiful day on the Oregon coast. So we have a quorum. Doug is at, where are you at this time?
Oregon Emergency Management Conference.
And so he's not here, so we constitute a quorum. First recognition and proclamation is Child Abuse Awareness and Prevention Month for Lincoln County. You want to read that one, Bill?
I would be happy to and invite our presenters up while I'm doing that. Whereas it is critical to Lincoln County's future that our children be safe, protected, and nurtured. And whereas the incidence of physical, emotional, and sexual abuse of children, as well as neglect of children, continues at an alarming level. And whereas effects of child abuse and neglect are felt by the entire community and need to be addressed by the entire community. And whereas it is essential that every citizen in Lincoln County become involved in supporting the efforts of parents and guardians to raise their children in a safe, nurturing environment. And whereas everyone must make a personal commitment to create and support the value that raising our children and supporting families is the responsibility of all citizens. Now, therefore, we, the Lincoln County Board of Commissioners, do hereby proclaim April 2017 as Child Abuse Awareness and Prevention Month in Lincoln County and encourage all citizens to join in the observance.
Welcome. Please identify yourself.
Thank you. I'm Paul Schrader, the Executive Director of the Lincoln County Children's Advocacy Center, and this is
Nicole Hadley, Darkness to Light Coordinator,
So I'd like to start off by showing a two-minute clip that Nicole has put together for us that illustrates the gravity of what we have here very well, I think.
And my eyes are all rise like the day. keeping lying. But I promise we would take the world to its feet.
Okay. Well, thanks for your patience in looking at that. That illustrates pretty well in details the problems that we have in the county and in the nation as a whole. In our county, Lincoln County is consistently in the bottom half and often the bottom quarter in terms of abuse rates in the state of Oregon. So what we do at the center and with our community partners is critically important here. At the center, we have an advocate and forensic interviewer that guide the children through the process. We have a trauma-informed counselor who will also assist in helping the children and their non-offending family members. We have a prevention specialist who goes out to the community to help train people to recognize child abuse and situations that can lead to child abuse. And so we're really trying to tackle the problem from all angles in terms of prevention, assistance, and then treatment afterwards. And we work very closely together with our community partners, many of whom are here in law enforcement, the VA's office, and Child Protective Services as well.
So you might ask you a question.
Please.
So when you come up and say it's the bottom half, are you talking per capita, per county, and then do all counties spend as much money and have as much support as this county does toward child abuse?
Those are good questions. It is per capita. So it's and as far as the resources expended on this, it's really difficult to tell. The support comes from different angles and from different places. There's financial support from state and local, federal governments, and fundraising. And many of the costs are hidden as well, as one of the slides illustrated over the lifetime of an individual who has had to deal with child abuse. The costs on the community are in the hundreds of thousands over their lifespan.
Thank you. Do you have any questions?
Is the darkness to light training still being rolled out in the community? I know I went through it a couple of years ago, and very enlightening, even for someone who, like me, who I think has had a little bit more education and contact on this than a lot of people, that I still felt like I learned a lot, had a few myths busted, so...
Yeah, I agree with you completely. Yeah. It is very enlightening, even for those of us who are in the field, and I do think it's critically important, and Nicole is our coordinator that handles that.
So could you maybe tell people just a little bit about what the training is, how long it takes, and if they're interested, how they can find out more?
It's a 2.5-hour training, generally, where we have videos from survivors' experience and kind of from what you saw from the video, 5 steps of how to implement that, and when you're addressed with child abuse, what to do. So overviews child abuse, sexual abuse overall. And so if they're interested in training, you would just call our center, or I have an email address that's attached to our website or our Facebook page, and just let us know if you're interested in training. We're reaching out to our partner sites. We're reaching out to school staff, after-school programs, anyone that works with children who are mandatory reporters, you name it. So I agree. Anyone who has an interest or works with kids could benefit.
Great. There's a tipping point in terms of trying to get that awareness out to a percentage of the population at which it's expected that there's an impact on the level of abuse rates.
And can I ask how close we are to achieving that tipping point for Lincoln County?
And it's a little, I stammer a little bit because it's been disjointed in terms of start to now. Mm-hmm. And the tipping point was initially thought to be around 5%, and I think we've already come close to that, if not surpass that a little bit, but I think that that point has moved up a little towards 7 or 8%.
Okay, so like when we get to 7 or 8% of the total county population trained, at least in theory, there should be a tipping point.
Yeah, and a reduction in child abuse.
Great, great. Okay.
So, and why don't you ask any more questions? Volunteers, you both work with volunteers, I assume. How does somebody go about volunteering for your groups?
Thank you, that's great. They can contact us through our website, through the phone, and once we are in contact with them, they have to go through a background check to ensure that anybody that comes into the center has to go through a background check, whether they're volunteers or employees. And once that process is complete, then we can get them scheduled to help out in whatever way they can there.
So we are pretty active in the outreach and preventative movement. We've gone to volunteer fairs that the committee has hosted, and just trying to reach out to different centers and make contact and let them know that we're getting organized, and put out our brochures about training that'll be happening soon. Hopefully to do trainings, the D2L trainings, once a month at our center or other places where there's a need. Just kind of figuring out.
Okay. Anything else you want to talk to us about?
I think that's enough for this morning, probably.
Many thanks.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else would like to talk on this subject? Because I see a lot of people I know they're involved.
Well, I'd like to bring up something, which is what you were bringing up again. I'm J.W. Huppa, yeah. Chief Deputy District Attorney. I'm the MDT Chair, which is the Child Abuse.
Come a little closer to the microphone.
Thank you. Make sure it's the Child Abuse and Sexual Assault County organization. Basically, we look at all the cases. And child abuse is one of those crimes, and what they're doing at the center, especially what they're doing with Darkness to Light, it's actually one of those crimes that can be prevented through education. Mm-hmm. And the reason is, most child abuse is done against a child by a caregiver. So it's one of those unusual crimes that if caregivers were just educated on their potential of harming a child, and anybody who has had kids and has multiple kids, and especially multiple kids, or has all these issues, whether it's a number of kids, pressure, financial pressure, whether it's any other side issue like drugs or alcohol or domestic relations, all those issues happen in a household, and a caregiver can potentially lash out at a child because children can be demanding. So the education part, that what they're doing is just really trying to help people seek resources and seek the ability to walk away and take a breath and take time so they don't take their frustration out on a child. And again, it can have a great effect, and so we really applaud what they're doing. We want to get ourselves lower on the county statistical level. We want to even reduce it even more, and we can't.
Well, let me ask you a question. You're involved with this, and a term that I hear now is mandatory reporters. And explain to me what a mandatory reporter is, and because I know that a few years ago I never heard the term, and all of a sudden I hear teachers and coaches and all kinds of people are mandatory reporters. Tell me what that means.
The legislature has been tackling this, and it's been a again, as far as because child abuse is a unique crime where the victim typically has difficulty speaking out and the perpetrator is likely to be someone close to the child, often that's been hidden because nobody will report this crime. This crime will be a secret crime. So what the legislature has been doing, and nationwide actually, been progressing towards requiring people that have contact with children to be aware and to notice and to say something. And they've since made it so it's mandatory. In other words, if you suspect a child's been abused and you're in a position that you see this and you suspect the child's abuse, you are required to report. And the mandatory reporter used to be a very limited group of people who was mandatory reported, and they since expanded it. Just about anybody that has contact with the child and has the ability to oversee the child or have a position where they can say something about this child. They know they have contact with the child. It's not just like briefly walking through a grocery store and you see the child, although they may be. Depends on what their role is. But if somebody's coming in contact with the child, if they have contact with the child and they suspect abuse, then they should notify authorities, either DHS or law enforcement. And again, it doesn't mean the child, we're going to assume that child has since been abused. It goes through a whole investigation. It goes through our MDT. Some people are afraid to report because they don't want to stigmatize someone by reporting. But it doesn't stop there. Just to report, many of them are screened out. They're not abused. Or they're investigated as non-abuse. Or they're investigated as suspected abuse. And then it comes to our MDT. We talk about it. We hash it out. We discuss it before anything happens to the parents or caregivers or whoever else potentially abuse a child. So there's a checks and balance process in place.
Thank you.
Just to put some some magnitude to the problem that we face here in our county, at the center we'll see hundreds of children throughout the year. We'll see in the neighborhood of 200 children for forensic interviews or medical exams on the average. We'll see in that ballpark 100, 150 children for counseling. We'll evaluate around 100 cases for Carley's Law incidents. As well.
Okay, explain so, Carley's Law.
Carley's Law is a situation where if there is any suspicious physical injury on a child, they have to be evaluated by a physician within 48 or 72 hours. And from that, someone needs to evaluate, and in our case, it's our medical professional, needs to evaluate the photographs and information obtained to determine whether or not there is a likelihood of physical abuse in that case.
Anything else?
Okay, just one comment on the medical. I'm sorry. Because they've been doing a great job at the CAC really developing services. And one of the things they're working on is they have a nurse practitioner who is qualified to see these children and review these cases. And she's basically doing it on her own time. And so she works as Samaritan. But she's working with Samaritans to try to get them to authorize her to spend more time. Because what has to happen is these kids end up in the emergency room because the law requires that somebody see them. So it takes resources away from the emergency room because many of these children, because we're not a large county and we don't have a full-time medical person on staff, they have to go to the emergency room. Ties up the emergency room, ties up time. The child has to go to an emergency room and sit in an emergency room. We're trying to work, and this Children's Advocacy Center is trying to work on moving that away from the emergency room, having a staff person, a medical person there, and it's a much more child-friendly environment for the child to come and get a medical exam. They have this great new equipment and set up for the exams. They just need the money to have the person there or work with the Samaritan's system to have this person that actually volunteers to spend more time there and really get the child away from the emergency room and into the center. So I'm putting a plug for that because I think that's I've heard about this, discussions that are going on. It's just really a great idea and a great way to help everybody.
Thank you. That's a high priority of mine, and the person that is dealing with that with us is Erin Carrington. She's a physician's assistant, and she's terrific. Her availability is really unbelievable. And it really is something that should be out of the ER whenever possible for a number of reasons. But one of those is that it's the people there are not comfortable and well-trained to deal with these circumstances. So they're uncomfortable, the children are uncomfortable. It just makes a lot of sense from every aspect to have this performed at the center when possible.
Okay. And we're putting out pinwheels in this room, and invite everyone to come after and put them out around the courthouse.
Today?
Yep. I know. Make it the best
day. You guys ought to take
a stand. Come on. Your coat.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much for coming.
Thanks.
Appreciate the work you're all doing.
Mr. Chair, I move that we approve this resolution proclaiming Child Abuse Awareness and Prevention Month in Lincoln County.
Second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Motion passes. We move down to consent calendar. Consent calendar things of routine nature as previously heard.
Mr. Belmont, is this a first? I can't ever remember in 30 years a blank consent calendar.
I don't know if it's the first, but it's very, very rare.
Yep. Yeah. So I guess we don't have to approve it since there's nothing on it. Wow.
I don't remember ever doing that before.
Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking 13 years as a commissioner and then 18 years going to these meetings as a reporter, and I never remember that. So but I guess there's a first time for everything.
No public hearings, no decision in action, and no consent calendar. So we move down to discussion information. 2017-2018 AT&T County Assessment Functions Funding Assistance Program. Please identify yourself.
Good morning, Commissioner. I'm Joe Davidson, Lincoln County Assessor. This is Claudia Tower, our Chief Office Deputy in the Assessor's Office. And we're here today to present our application for participation in the 2017-18 CAFA grant. This is the County Assessment Function Funding Assistance Program. It was introduced by the legislature in 1989 through House Bill 2338. And it was an attempt to ensure support at the time for assessment tax-related expenses. This was following a period of recession in the 1980s. Counties were struggling with budget cuts and struggling to maintain regular appraisal cycles and accurate market values. And so this was sort of a legislative attempt to resolve some of these issues by providing financial support for AP services, which in turn was supposed to lead to more fair and equitable assessment taxation. Now, the interesting thing about this grant program is that it's actually funded by county revenue. Fees collected from recording documents in the county clerk's office, as well as a percentage of delinquent tax interest, is deposited into a local county assessment tax fund, and then this money is then transferred to a state CAFA account, which is managed by the Oregon Department of Revenue. And that account builds interest. The state takes 10% for their own appraisal purposes, as they are in charge of appraising some of our high-dollar industrial properties, as well as some centrally assessed utility accounts throughout the state. So they take 10% for those purposes. And then the remaining amount in the account is then distributed back to the counties based on the amount of expenditures that they file in relation to one another. And so it's all proportionate. Obviously, the larger counties are going to get more back because they have more expenditures for their day-to-day operations, and vice versa for the smaller counties. And we'll get a little bit more into the history of our county and the effect of this program in Lincoln County in a little bit. But if you look at your handouts, this is similar documents that we've given you in the past. The first section, it's broken up into three sections. First section is a summary of this year's grant documents. Second section is last year's, just for comparison. And then the third section is the history, as I was talking about. And so if you turn to page one, this is actually form one of our application. And it's kind of a basic overview of the staffing for A&T purposes. It's broken down by department. And as you can see, that this doesn't only include the assessor's office, but actually it includes the tax office as well, and extends to a portion of the clerk's office. that's responsible for our BOPTA process. That's the Board of Property Tax Appeals. That's kind of a shared responsibility, so we do claims and staffing there. And also our IT department for data processing and some of our computer support. We claim some FTE in that office as well. As you can see, year over year, 2016-17 to 2017-18, the total number of FTEs for A&T is virtually the same. There's a portion in the tax office that went up, but just a fraction, basically claiming more support on the treasurer's side for tax-related questions over the phone and at the counter, but everything else is the same. Form 2 is the actual summary of our expenses. This is what the department's going to look at when determining how much to give us back. And you can also look in the second section, the same form, to kind of see the year-over-year change. At the top is our personnel services. That's actually gone down a little bit since last year, and that's simply due to the fact that we've had some retirements. Some people leave the office over the last year, including my predecessor, Rob Thomas, also our chief office deputy, and a former appraiser that had been here for a number of years. Those positions were replaced at a lower pay rate, and so that's reflected there in the lower amount of personnel services. Next, materials and services, and also transportation. Those are basically the same. The main change here on this form is at the lower section under capital outlay, we're claiming an amount for an upgrade to our software system this year. This is something we've been preparing for financially for a number of years now. We've been using the same system since about the 1980s. It's been a great system, but it is starting to show some inefficiencies, as well as a lack of support and some recent hardware failures. And so we're trying to get a jump start on upgrading that software. This amount claimed is kind of a reflection of the licensing fees as well as a portion of the implementation fees for 2017-18. And we do anticipate this to be about a 2 to 3 year process, and so there will likely be more claimed for next year under capital outlay. Section 2, it's the same two forms as I mentioned, just for comparison purposes. And Section 3 is a little more interesting. It kind of gives a background year-to-year changes of this program and its effect in Lincoln County. This goes back to 1998-99. And this first couple pages is a percentage of the funding as compared to our overall expenditures for A&T. If you look back at 98-99, we started at 22% of funding for as compared to our expenditures. That went up slightly, especially in 2001 and 2002. That's when the state was kicking in some additional special payments out of the state general fund to help supplement that account, upwards of $5 million, I believe, at a time. That was in effect for about an eight-year period and was eventually phased out in 2009-10. And you can see that basically since that time, this is kind of the percentage of our expenditures covered by this funding has trickled back down. And we're all the way down to about 16.5% this year. And that's just an estimate. That could be a little bit higher. But we're basically using the same estimate of funding as last year for this coming year. The next page is just a breakdown of, proportionate to what department covers A&T. As you can see, assessor's office and tax office takes up a large percentage of the total A&T functions and a small percentage for BOPTA and IT support.
Since you mentioned BOPTA,
sure.
You might, some people don't know what BOPTA is, and it's one of the questions I get asked about a lot. How do I go about making a tax?
Yeah, BOPTA, it's our Board of Property Tax Appeals. It's a volunteer board of three people generally. And, if you disagree with your market value on your property, you have the option to appeal the value if you have certain evidence why it should be lower. And the board hears your case. They hear our case. Sometimes, we'll review your property, and we might agree. and we'll stipulate at a lower value. But if we disagree, we'll show the board our evidence on the assessor's side, and the appellant will show their evidence, and the board comes to a conclusion as far as the market value.
So give me an idea how often you decide in the case of the person that's made a claim to Bob. What's the situation? That's the kind of questions I have. Oh, they never give you anything.
Actually, this last year we had quite a number of stipulations where we heard the case, and a lot of times people will appeal after they buy a property. And this board, historically over the last several years, if it's a fair market sale, they're going to give you that sale price as your market value, regardless of other data. And so a lot of times we'll just stipulate to that value if it was a fair open market sale. In other cases, if they have a fee appraisal, and they use some comparable sales in there, we might see some different comparable sales and fight for our value on record. And then the board, that's the neutral party, they decide what's the best evidence of market value. But there is quite a bit of a success rate of reducing those market values for people that appeal.
So explain to me why that money comes through this state program, because a lot of people don't understand that.
Well, it's a function of assessment and tax.
So it's supporting the operation of BOP,
sure.
Not necessarily, this doesn't represent the difference between an initial assessment and...
No, this is just supporting that position in the clerk's office, because they actually oversee the BOPTA process. It's a separate position in the clerk's office that actually manages all the appeals, scheduling, and recording those appeals. And so we're just claiming that portion of FTE for that position.
That's what I was looking for.
Yes, yeah, sure.
So that people understood it wasn't.
Yeah. Like I said, this was just a breakdown of each department and its portion of total ante function. That's really unchanged over the years. The last page is probably the most interesting. This is a letter that our treasurer supplies us each year, and it's just a simple breakdown of how much money we give out each year into this CAFA account and how much money comes back to us. If you look at from 2001 until 2008, that was that period we talked about where those special payments were being kicked in by the state. And that's really the only period where we were getting back more than we were giving out. Other than that, we're actually losing money on this deal. And that's, part of that has to do with the state taking 10% for their own appraisal purposes. But we are more of a donor county in this program. And as you get more and more population, the larger counties are giving a lot more to the state and to other counties, subsidizing other counties for this program. And vice versa for the smaller counties. That's basically it. I'm open for questions, but the reason I'm presenting all this to you is because with this application, we need a resolution from the board, basically approving this application, these expenditures, and we get that resolution to submit with our application to the state by May 1st in order to continue to qualify for this program. And we do have this scheduled as a decision and action item on next week's agenda for that purpose.
So going back to trying to use one of Doug's training, clarify things a little better.
Sure.
Why the state does this program is because it eliminates the possibility that a county may assess value to directly enhance their own pocket by doing this and teach away. Is that the correct answer? What's the correct answer?
Why the state
does this program?
Well, going back to the history, this was created at a time when counties were really in budget crisis. They had problems with staffing. Back then, there was actually counties were required to maintain a 6-year appraisal cycle. They were required to go to a property every 6 years physically and appraise it. That's gone away, but during the creation of this grant program, that requirement was in place. And so it's just basically remained in place over the year. We still, even though we're not required to maintain a six-year cycle, it is still very important to maintain accurate market values. And I think that's kind of why they kept us in place, because they recognize that importance, because market value does still come into play in a lot of ways. And even though the amount of funding has gone down, it's still 16%. That's still a big deal for us, for A&T function. And so I don't know if that really answered your question.
Kind of. Wayne, do you want to explain why they do it?
Maybe it's a little historical background here. At the time, this was done, I think, as the assessor was saying. This was done to try and equalize expenditures across the state and actually bring all the programs to kind of a comparable level. In fact, DOR, at the beginning of this, used to go out and do an audit of all the various assessor's departments and tell you need this many appraisers and this many cartographers and this much. They would actually do some staffing analysis and then come back to the counties and tell us we had to do that, and here's the money to do it. Now, associated with that idea was the fact that they were going to pick up 50% of the cost, if you recall.
I remember right. That. Yep.
So, and we got to around, what was it, 43% one year, and now we're down to 16%.
A historic low.
Yeah, historic low. So I think it still serves a good purpose in it. I think, as Assessor Davidson was saying, this really does provide us with some additional resources. And Department of Revenue is not no longer trying to hold our feet to the fire on staffing, at least the way they used to. I remember we had numerous discussions with the Department of Revenue, and in fact, at one point, we're ready to litigate with them over some issues related to them, because they were not fulfilling their promises, but trying to hold our feet to the fire, you know, in terms of expending dollars here. That's number one. So I think it does serve a good purpose, and it does help us to provide a better assessment system overall. The other part of this thing that has always kind of grated on us is the fact that we have to provide this grant application and commit our dollars before we've even begun our budget process. You know, it's like we don't start with a zero budget and kind of decide where we're going. This is plugged in. So you're stuck with having to present this to the budget committee as an accomplished fact.
Done deal.
You know, here's a done deal. This is your budget. And that's always grated us tremendously hard. So, but it is what it is. And so it's a continuation of a program that provides you with some funding, not what was promised, and some requirements that we have to meet before the budget, but it is what it is.
Well, the reason for my question was if I lose money, I'd like to know I'm doing it for a good cause. And so
definitely.
Kind of explained it. Okay. Thank you.
Commissioners, what we'll do now is we'll put the resolution on to, unless there's any other questions or concerns, we'll put the resolution on to next week's calendar.
Fine.
Okay.
I agree.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. So, I got to move to the right page again. We have a federal land access program for the Five Rivers Road paving project. Roy Kenyon?
You want that back on?
We can put it on if you'd like to look at it.
I'll do it.
What we're trying to do is find a good representation of the area that's in question. It's such a large area, we're having trouble finding a good map, but we're going to give it a shot.
Time being, we'll put this down and I'll fix that here. Let's see that.
Sit on this side of the table with me. Well, I'll get started. My name is Roy Kenyon. I'm the Public Works Director for Lincoln County. And what brings me here today is a discussion of, like Commissioner Thompson said, a FLAP project. What that is, federal land access. Every two or three years, the opportunity to apply for one of these projects comes up. In 2016, the Lincoln County Road Department applied for a FLAP through the Federal Western Lands Highway Division for asphalt overlay on Five Rivers Road, which is located at approximately milepost 20 off of Highway 34. So we're talking the extreme southeast corner of the county, one of those areas that's actually really hard to get any kind of reasonably cheap work done there, maybe just because it's so far removed from any place else in the county. And so what we're applying for was asphalt overlay of 10.5 miles, which is actually the full length of Five Rivers Road. And in order to qualify for this project, it has to meet a few guidelines. One is, of course, it has to access federal lands. And in the Five Rivers drainage, there is roughly 50,000 acres of federal land that accesses through Five Rivers. And also, you have to show a need. And our need was that the Forest Service projects over the next 10 to 15 years that there will be 50 to 80 million board feet of timber taken out of that area using Five Rivers Road.
50 to 80 million board feet over how long?
Yeah, over the next 10 to 15 years. And in layman's terms, we're looking at roughly 10,000 to 16,000 loads of logs coming down that road in the next 10 to 15 years. And also, to qualify for the project, you need basically qualify or put up a match to whatever the total amount of the project is. And the way the funds break down here is that the overall value of the project is approximately $2.9 million. And of that $2.9 million, first of all, Lincoln County is required to put up a 10.27% match. And that's a federal requirement. That's a standard match. And that comes up to roughly $250,000. And because these flaps are competitive, it's an open application. Agencies throughout Oregon, anybody that has a road that accesses into federal land, BLM land, is able to apply. We needed to sweeten the pot. And so we put up as an in-kind match prep work done by our own Lincoln County Road Department crew. That means the crack sealing, the patching and repairing of the existing surface, preparing it for an overlay. And the value of that is roughly $250,000. And that's basically personnel costs and equipment costs, something that we take on a daily basis anyway. We'll just be working on Five Rivers Road for a while. And then to try to sweeten the pot even a little more, we threw in a $200,000 cash match. And that cash is actually coming through what we call an STP payment. And that's a surface transportation project. And this is money that we receive annually, but we only retrieve it, or I guess actually get our hands on that money, when we ask for reimbursement for projects that are already done. And so our annual payment is roughly between $400,000 and $420,000 a year. In order to get our hands on the money, we actually have to claim it as a reimbursement for a project already done. So we've been working on claiming money that was spent in like the 2011-2012 year for this project. We will be asking for reimbursement for money spent on asphalt paving projects from 2013-2014. So it's money already spent. This is just reimbursement for that I'm going to turn over and put towards this asphalt project. And so really, when it's all said and done, there really isn't anything that's coming out of our reserves that's really coming out of our operation budget. This is all money that we're maneuvering from other places to do this.
So ask a couple of questions, Mr. Chair?
Go ahead.
Okay, so essentially this road needs a new overlay, that it's beyond the point where...
The last asphalt overlay that was done on this road was in 1989.
Okay, then
and
yes.
And that was paving that was done from milepost 0 or Highway 34 up to Denver Bridge, which is approximately milepost 3.
Only that 3-mile stretch.
Yeah,
so the rest of it.
Yeah,
is older
as you go
than
further
that.
Up the creek, the asphalt gets older and older.
Yeah. And the federal lands that are going to see the timber harvest, you happen to know, is that Forest Service land?
That is, BLM? That is Forest Service land. Yeah, all of our numbers came from the Forest Service.
Okay.
So I'll ask the question, expected life for a road is 20 years, is that right?
Expected life for a road is, yeah, roughly 20 years for an asphalt, two-inch asphalt.
31 years into that road since we did it. So
for the newest part, and you're saying the rest is even older.
Yeah, the newest asphalt there, is roughly 89, 99. We're 27, 28 years. And by the time we get to the project, which is actually scheduled for 2019, it will be at 30 years.
Okay.
And then beyond that, I'm not sure when the upper reaches were paved, but sometime prior to 1989.
So, and you may not know the answer to this, but since you're talking 50 to 80 million board feet of federal timber harvest, how much of that will wind up back as revenue to the county?
I'm not sure how that all filters through. I know that the 50 to 80 million that they're going to log out of there is less than what their annual take is. I mean, we're just talking, you know, one area, and it's going to be scattered over 10 or 15 years. And so really you're only looking at, what are we looking at, 4 million feet a year on the average. As far as what we're going to see, I don't know what that is. I can't imagine it would be much.
Do you have any idea if this is thinning or this is... Because a lot of the site is older timber.
Yeah, this is all thinning of reprod. That they aren't logging anything that resembles an old tree.
One of the things that, if you remember right, when the Forest Service said here, they were looking at 8, 10, 12 years, and then they were looking at virtually no harvest in that area.
I understand that. And like I said, these are the numbers that we received from the Forest Service towards the end of last year. And so, as far as I know, these are good numbers.
Yeah, this is why I was surprised, like you. I was thinking that with the move of the Siusla to what they call it, late secessional reserve, that we wouldn't be seeing much harvest activity. But if
this they did hedge it by saying
thinning,
8 to 10 years before they would make that reduction.
Right.
So this is...
And all this wood could actually come out in the next 10 years, you know. I mean, they were using some very large round numbers. We needed to get an idea of how much use the federal government was going to have on this road, because that's the essence of the program is to, if they're going to use the road, they need to help pay for, you know, maintenance on it. And in this case, it's logging purposes. In other cases, it's access just to recreation area. You know, there's a lot of places, especially over east of the mountains, where there's some very highly used recreation areas that they utilize a county road to actually get up into the hills. And so this is their way of trying to ensure that the roads leading into their ground are safe and well-maintained.
Okay.
And what I'm actually here today is that the first process is an agreement that just Lincoln County agrees to pay a 10.27% match. That's the first step in this. That's a fairly simple process. Okay. It's going to take us...
If we get our money back out of it, I think.
Yeah, I would think so.
I don't have a problem.
Okay, so can we move this forward?
Consent calendar, and we have the document we designed next week.
Okay.
Roy, I'm going to ask you a question. But do we have any other projects like this, Hang Fire, out there that might develop in Lincoln County in the next 3-4 years?
Well, yes, we have another one that we're currently working on with the Forest Service. We have not reached any agreements yet. It's all in the works. But we've had some really good conversations with the Forest Service about doing some pavement on Fall Creek Road, off of Highway 34. It actually, Fall Creek leaves Highway 34 about mile post 28 and leads into the Oregon Fish and Wildlife Hatchery and Research Center. And for years, it's been a very sensitive area due to the proximity of the road to the stream and the heavy use from multiple timber owners. And we run into problems with sediment in the stream. And so the Forest Service actually is going to have several large timber sales up there in the next few years. And as part of that, they're willing to provide $250,000 towards paving of Fall Creek Road to decrease the amount of sediment that would enter into the stream during the winter months. We've actually had some conversations with some other entities that may be contributing. And as of this point, I don't know what our budget is going to look like at the beginning of the 2018-19 budget. And so I haven't committed anything other than in-kind work. So prep, there again, prep to the road. So we're going to use our equipment and our labor as kind of a match or our part of the project. But it's at the very beginning stages of that process.
Since a lot of federal land is concentrated in the Alsea Basin, and those two are at the very extreme ends of the county.
Mm-hmm.
And downriver, we have still got a lot of federal land that's in there. Is there any talk on other roads? Because some of that asphalt is getting real old in some of the lower.
It is. But as far as the county road system is involved on highway, on the Alsea drainage, we really only have one other paved road, and that's Ekman Creek Road. And we're actually dealing with the federal government through FEMA to try to still fix a washout that we had in December 2015. But the asphalt on Ekman Creek is starting to get a little tired, just like all the rest of ours. Ekman Creek does actually lead into a fairly large chunk of Forest Service ground. But I don't know if it actually would qualify for a flap. Our next attempt at a flap, we believe, is going to be North Beaver Creek. So from Highway 101 up to the end of the pavement, it's approximately 3 miles. They're actually logging, the Forest Service is logging quite heavily out of there now as we speak. And they do have some plans to continue that on for the near future. And so the next flap cycle, we believe we're going to actually apply for kind of the same thing, an asphalt overlay with some guardrail update and stuff on North Beaver Creek.
One last question, if you don't mind.
I just need to remind you, I do have to leave, I'm sorry, at 10:30 for Salem, and we got another presentation.
Okay, well, we'll pass that question then.
Okay.
So come back again, we'll talk about it.
I'll be back.
Canal Creek, so you don't move around.
Okay.
Okay, we move down to reports, public annual reports.
My apologies that I may have to leave before we're finished with this.
We won't make any votes after this, Salem.
Yeah. So this is just a report. I'm Rebecca Austin from Lincoln County Public Health. I'm the director. And I'm here today to present to you our second annual report about public health services in Lincoln County. Since you are the Board of Health and ultimately responsible for public health services, it's important that you know what we're doing. And I did this last year for your board meeting when you were in Walport. So like I said, this is the second one. And I just want to highlight a few things for you. So this is all about what happened in 2016. And you know that in 2016, couple big things happened for public health. One is that we're moving towards a modernized public health system across the state. And the other is that Lincoln County is going to be accredited, hopefully this year. So my health promotion manager, who's also the accreditation coordinator, and I went to Washington, D.C. this past year in November and got all trained up in how to do this accreditation thing, and we've come home and been working hard on it since. And so I just want to step you through a few things here. You'll see on the third page after the table of contents a little comment about just what I said just now, a little report out about how overall how things are going. Our mission, vision, and guiding principles. And then on the next page over, you'll see that we have adopted a public health performance management system, and that's the circle that you see there. It's a process of setting standards, how we're going to measure those standards. If we, or while we're collecting data, if we see that we're not meeting our standards, we go into a quality improvement process and then reporting out. So that's a whole system we put in place over the last year, and we feel like this is going to really help us meet some of our goals and be more accountable to public health services in the county. And then on the next page, I just included on page 5 sort of the model that we're looking at for public health modernization in Oregon. So you can see the kind of blue boxes across the top are the programs, and then the circles down below it are all of the capabilities that we want to try to instill in each one of these programs. And I talk a little bit about you as our Board of Health, that you have also appointed a Public Health Advisory Committee. And then I go in and talk about all the different sections that we have and what programs fall under each one of those sections. So you know our logo is the three branches. So that's prevention, promotion, and protection. And we have fitted each one of our programs under each one of those branches. And then I gave you some infographics just to give you some highlights of what's going on in the county and what kind of drives public health. We're very data-driven, so we collect a lot of data, we assess a lot of data, we analyze it, and we try to make decisions on where best to put our resources and how to address the problems. So you see on the top there is our communicable disease chart. It's probably not the... I'm not so sure I like the way that they did this, but it gives you an idea of what is going down and what is going up. It's a little hard sometimes to figure out what color is that exactly, but I don't know if you want me to go into that or not. You can kind of peruse that.
Could you touch one area for me?
Yeah.
Hepatitis C, I hear there's more better drugs that are helping make this chart go down.
Well, it won't make, it's not a preventative. It's not like a vaccine. So, well, it's a drug that they've come up with that can treat Hep C, and really, it's very expensive. I don't know who's going to be able to afford it. And it will probably be, it's not like a cure. It will help manage symptoms.
Okay, thank you.
No, it's a really good question. And, you know, you never know. Things are always happening. Things are changing. So someday it'd be nice to have a vaccine so we don't have. We have one for Hep B, we have one for Hep A, we don't have one for Hep C. So the infographics are just for you to look over. So you kind of know, I mean, definitely gives you the breadth of all the work that we do. If we're collecting this data and we have something that's addressing it, then, you know, we're doing a lot of work. And then we just, I just wanted to give you a couple snapshots. The first one is our accreditation. We've set some goals for ourselves because our time is up. The clock started ticking after our training in November in Washington, D.C. last year. So we have exactly a year from that time to get all of our documentation uploaded. And so we've set ourselves a goal. Both Nicole and I are not good at pushing ourselves against a deadline. So we have set ourselves to have all of our documentation uploaded by late July. So that's how much we hate being pushed up against a deadline. And so then we set up some times. You can see that a little charting here that we wanted to have 10% uploaded by the end of January, which we met. And then we had our next goal was to have 30% of all of our documents uploaded by the end of March. We missed that just by a few days, but I'm told coming into this meeting that we've hit that 30% and actually exceeded it by a little bit. So it's important to remember that for accreditation, it really helps build an excellent public health department. And for the most part, we do a lot of the things that they want us to be doing, but we haven't been really good at documenting that we're doing it. So that's a lot of what we're doing now, is trying to come up with that documentation, making sure that we have minutes to meetings that say that we're doing these trainings or whatever it may be. So we're kind of gathering those all up, and so that's what I'm talking about when we're uploading documents, when we're finding something or we're, you know, writing a policy for something, then we're uploading it into the accreditation's data system. And that's how they'll finally, all the little buttons will turn green, and then we'll know we're ready to have our site visit. So that's kind of our goal. And then I wanted to just make sure that you knew that we're still very involved in the mental health first aid trainings. In fact, I think we had some data on that. Maybe not in this one. But we are keeping track of our what trainings we're doing. And then we're just highlighting some of our programs and showing you some of our staff and sometimes not so serious poses. And then just a closing statement with a picture of the whole team, which is about 25 of us now, I think.
So, Mr. Chair, could I just make some parting comments? I very much appreciate this report. I read through it yesterday when I got my meeting packet. I'm going to be doing further review. I'd like to encourage members of the public who are interested to really take a look at this, because we post our BOC meeting packets online following the meeting. There is a lot of exciting data in here. I just want to say, as always, nice to hear progress on this good work, and a parting thought that ties in not only with this presentation but our earlier presentation from the Children's Advocacy Center. If only, I think we're making headway, but we've got to work harder at education and prevention in so many areas. Is going to save us not only so much expense, but so much preventable human misery down the road. So
absolutely.
May that get to every ear. And one small encouraging thing I'm hearing, you know, as everybody knows, I'm spending a lot of time in Salem this year with my AOC president hat, and I'm hearing discussion that despite the dire state budget situation, there is an awareness of the importance of the public health modernization, and within whatever resources are available, the legislature is very much interested in keeping it on track.
So, right. That's good news.
Thanks for an excellent report, and we'll see you.
Do you want to give any kind of commissioner's report?
No.
That's good.
We're good. Yeah. So this report is also up on our webpage, so people can access it there as well.
Yeah, it is massive progress here. It's that's exciting. It's for a long time been going. Some of these areas have been going down.
Well, we're still struggling, that's for sure. But I feel like we're getting kind of a base to sort of address things. So we're working on it.
Great.
Thank you.
Thanks for your staff and all the things you're doing. That's good news.
Thanks.
We do go down to commissioner's reports, and since I'm the only one, I'll use Wayne. Wayne, do you want to explain what happened last week at University of Oregon Law School, since you were here at the podium with me?
Commissioner Thompson was invited to be a keynote speaker at a symposium on ocean issues that dealt with things ranging from ocean acidification to sea level rise to alternative energy and how that might apply. And very interesting conference, a mixture of scientists and attorneys and law students, since it was at the University of Oregon School of Law. So the commissioner invited me to go along with him so that we could actually present the keynote speech together. And we've done this a couple of times where we get together and seem to feed off each other in terms of talking about the local perspectives on these, what are state and national issues. And I think we talked about a great perspective that we have in the county that really focuses a lot on, you know, the role that we play in implementation of some of the programs, but also our real support for a lot of the movers and shakers in this particular area, especially the education and research that's being done on the ocean and ocean-related issues. And I think that local perspective sometimes sorely lacks in some of these things, so it was really a great opportunity for us to talk about what's happening here in Lincoln County and other parts of the Oregon coast.
Well, I was flattered to be asked to speak before it, because the University of Oregon Law School is one of the leaders in ocean law, and for me, a fisherman, and let's say not a straight-A student, was flattered that I'd be asked, but Wayne did an excellent job, and we do it. We try to add a little humor to it and try to give a good presentation. We've done it now two or three different times and shared the podium, and it worked real well and well-received, so thank you very much for helping me out on that issue. And there's two reasons I take you, Wayne. One is, of course, your skill and knowledge in the area, and the other is if they start throwing tomatoes, I can duck behind you.
No tomatoes were thrown, I can attest to that.
Okay, I was going to mention a couple other things that bills that Monday that came up. Arnie Roblin has worked years on getting the Ocean Trust Fund, and it passed and was sent down to Ways and Means. Lincoln County did put a small amount of money in it, and one of the environmental groups, I believe, put a very small amount of money into it, but it becomes a funding source for a place to house money that comes in from different groups that can be then sent into a science-based projects. And we're going to see a lot of this, I think, come in the future in ocean acidification in some of these areas. It'll be an essential tool that, in order to keep that money so that it's really science-orientated. And there's it's been a long time coming. I think it's over 6 years we've worked to try to get this in place. It's a real challenge. And the other bill is a bill that was also sent to Ways and Means, and Arnie Roblin and all of them, a lot of fishermen, a lot of people in Lincoln County worked on, and that's PMEC. There's basically $40 million in the pot now, and we have to raise 10% of that money approximately as a match locally, but there's $40 million there that we'll go to build the energy center here, a testing site off of Newport. And that is, I think, the right way to do this kind of research, is to bring them into a testing site so it's one location so that we can monitor. There'll be grid-connected links from there back to the beach, and we can monitor all the things that go on there. There's one like this. I think it's in Orkney, or it's over Scotland, in that area, yeah. Scotland.
Yeah.
And it's been very successful and created a lot of jobs and a lot of good research in the area. Of course, when it comes to this, I keep reminding people our energy costs are low, but if we develop the technology here, we can export it to other parts of the world that has high hydrocarbon costs for energy, and I think that we're the right location to do it because the Marine Science Center houses all the different agencies that we have here, and we're a short distance to the deep water site, and so I'm excited to see that. I hope within the next few years it creates a lot of jobs and revenue for our county to help us prosper. Any constituent input? Seeing none. I think we're coming back on Wednesday, the April 19th. Will be held here at the Board of Commissioners room at 9:30. With that, meeting adjourned.